Hi everyone, Denise here, and welcome again to a new episode of the Oxford Policy Podcast. Today is a very special day since we commemorate International Women's Day. And thinking about International Women's Day means considering both the rights we have achieved and those yet to come. I believe in highlighting our progress, but even more so in addressing the areas where we still fall short. We must now stay silent or accept the status quo. Women's power has been evident in various social and economic spheres, with politics being particularly contentious. This is the focal point that brings me here today. While more women are participating in politics worldwide, particularly in regions like Americas and Europe, we cannot yet claim to compete on equal footing with men. Women who aspire to enter politics face various forms of aggression and intimidation, which deter them from pursuing these spaces. Threats and harassment of women in politics pose a significant challenge to democracy, as it is not just about gaining power, but also about effectively using it while in office. To delve into this phenomenon, I have invited Karin Zichen, an Ecuadorian lawyer and, I'm proud to say, MPP alumni, who served as Undersecretary of Regulatory Affairs in the Ecuadorian presidency last year. Karin was at the forefront of one of the country's most pivotal political moments, the popular referendum. During that time, Karin was a victim of political violence, particularly through social media. And I can attest that this harassment continues to this day. Unluckily. Karin, welcome to the Oxford Policy Podcast. Thank you for joining us and thank you for your time.
Hi, Denise. No, thank you for inviting me.
Before we delve into the challenges women face in entering politics, could you tell us why is it relevant for a healthy democracy to have more women in politics? Some may argue it is not a gender issue.
So I do believe it is important to have women in politics. I believe that women bring to the table different points of view, different mechanisms to arrive into important decisions, different leadership strategies. Women, without a doubt, improve representation. However, I also believe that we should look for ethical and prepared women in politics. I do not support these oversimplifications of the human condition to raise gender or sexual orientation. Women are, without a doubt, valuable to politics, precisely because of our differences with men. And that is the reason why I think it's crucial to have women in politics, not only because It improves representation, but also I think we contribute to our to leadership and to decision making in our own way. I think that is what makes us stronger and valuable. But I was thinking about this question, which I think it can be a bit controversial, and I think it's important for people to discuss it openly and honestly. And I think that there are factors, particularly when talking about political representation, that should be valued more than just gender. So, for instance, for me, ethical conditions and ethical actions display more an actual character. And that is what we should be focusing on when we choose our leaders and when we choose who are the people that are representing us. I think that gender, sadly, is not a guarantee for anything. So I was recently watching the news, and as you know, Denise, particularly in Ecuador, these past few weeks have been crazy because the national prosecutor, the general prosecutor, has unplugged a lot of corruption. And for me, it has been so interesting to see the role of women in these organized crime nets. And so yesterday, the former provincial president, who is a woman, was detained in the case called The Purge. So sadly, we see how corruption, particularly when it comes to organized crime and when it comes to public services, does not discriminate between gender. And of course, there are different evidences. So there are people who think that women are less likely to commit corruption acts, and there are people that think that no, cultural environment is more important. But regardless of that, I do think that when we aspire for women in politics, we should aspire for ethical leadership most than anything.
Can you please tell me more about the ethical considerations you mentioned? How do you understand it?
Yes, of course. So when it comes to ethical leadership, I think the little things and the big things matter. And I want to say that being, so you mentioned my experience, so being a political figure, trying to impulse or to communicate the intricacies of a referendum was a bit challenging. And of course, you're a human. And of course, you make mistakes. And you're weak at some moments. And at some moments, you're strong. So that is what a leader should try to encapsulate, the humanity of being a politician, a real politician. I think is one of the most beautiful parts of getting into politics. And I believe that what women bring into this discussion, what it takes for a woman to show strength, but at the same time, commitment to our cause, it is tremendously important, particularly in a country like Ecuador, where political leadership in general, women or men, are lacking leaders or role models to follow.
Great. I want to ask you something aligned to making mistakes, because as you know, the political system expects us to be perfect. Yeah, the political system expects perfection from us. And I feel that it happens, especially in Latin America and not to say Ecuador. But we're humans and we will make mistakes. And in that sense, could you tell us something you regret doing? What could you have done differently? Tell me more about those mistakes.
Oh, that is a big question. I'm not sure that I have processed all of that, all of the mistakes I've made. Of course, you can always do a better job. So I would like to say that I would, looking back, I would like to work on being more calm. I was very stressed all the time, and I felt the weight of the country on my shoulders. And that was a mistake, because it didn't only depend on what I did. And sometimes that can lead you to not necessarily make the best decisions. And also, it took a toll on my health. It took a toll on my personal relationships and on my overall wellness. So I would just like to looking back, just realized that not everything depended on me. So I think that was my biggest mistake, maybe thinking I was responsible for everything.
I definitely agree. And I want to move forward to the fact that women are fully aware in this case of that violence that is constantly surrounding them. You know, I think as women, we just become accustomed to it, especially politics. How did you navigate this awareness while leading the popular referendum? Please share some of your experiences.
Yeah, so the way I navigate it is basically my team got me through. I had a wonderful small team of people. That was how I surrounded myself with people that I could trust. I used to joke with them and tell them that they are like Spartans, because our core team was made up with myself and two other people, a woman and a man. And my right hand, so the person that was my second aboard, was a younger woman, also Amalia. And I think that one of my biggest successes, now that we talked about my mistakes, was actually...
I know.
Yeah, was actually choosing my team. And I chose them because, of course, first of all, because of their honesty, I know that they were never going to get in anything shady. Their commitment to our work and to our country, but also because they thought differently than I did. So I value a lot diversity, and because I have a strong opinions, I like to have people around that have different opinions and that can defend their views. And they were like that. So they always kept me focused. And whenever we knew that there were going to be different difficult times. So whenever I felt like my faith was shaking or I was feeling weak, I used to look to them and see their commitment and see how much they worked. And they actually inspired me. They inspired me a lot to just keep going. Of course, my superiors were very important. They gave me unconditionally support and respect. They trusted me, which also helped me trust myself. And they gave me perspective when mine was blurring. So yeah, basically navigated through all of that with a wonderful team of people. So it wasn't just me going to national television or doing these debates. I had a team of people behind me that they were wonderful.
Connected to that, I find completely unfair that in addition to fulfilling your political responsibilities, which I know were a lot, and I can say that because I also come from the public sector, although I was in a completely different scenario than you, but I do get it. In that sense, women also had to focus on how to reduce or prevent these threats. And maybe it was your case. Maybe your attention was so dispersed. In that sense, do you think that the harassment got you distracted from your main political duties?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah. So I think I know what you mean. I believe that politics is a violent field, like for women and for men. But I also believe that there are certain types of violence that are most likely to happen to women. So what I found more like the biggest burden for me, or the heaviest burden, was to how I sometimes had to modify my personality for professionally speaking. So of course, I understand that women and men have to modify their personality for a professional setting. But I think that women have to bear that in mind more than men. So I have to be more serious, maybe less caring, less funny. And at the end of the day, because I used to work 16, 20, 22 hours a day, that would really took a toll on me, on my well-being, because it's like I was living these two personalities. But anyway, yeah.
That is not sustainable at all. I was talking with a friend about that, about, you know, how we tend to make politics and political institutions a male field.
Yeah.
And as a woman, we have to, we have this desire, of course, to participate in politics, but we want to be us. I don't want to be or act like a man just to be respected. And I think that's just not sustainable over time. Although, as you said, in politics, you have two personalities. But that's just simply not sustainable. In that sense, how can we change that? Should we change that?
So I think it's going to take time. Women entering the workforce, just the workforce, is pretty recent event. So
yeah,
I hope that in time men will adjust to working with women, and also women will adjust working with men. And I think in time we will feel more comfortable being ourselves and not necessarily send the wrong message. But as you said, this is something that happens to men as well. I mean, because politics is like what it is. It can get dirty. People usually have a different, like they modify their personality a little bit to fit in. And that is, I think, for me, that was the hardest thing to do.
I want to talk more about violence itself, the type of violence you experienced.
Yeah.
From what I've noticed, I know you received a lot of social media harassment. But apart from that, what else was there?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, politics is not easy. So so in social media, the most, like I'd say, the most common violence, sadly, it came from women. So I got a lot of comments on the way I dressed, the way I looked, the way my hair was made, critics about my intimate life, my private decisions.
And you were perfect, I remember. What can people say?
You're so kind. But no, that was the main. So my team would report to me, and they were like, most of them are women, and that is very sad. But also, I received death threats, which, I mean, those were the scariest. Particularly now, looking back and seeing how those might not have been just threats, because as you know, a few months ago, Fernando Villavicencio, a former candidate president, was killed. And the political violence has escalated to levels that we never thought it was possible. So now, looking back at them, I think I see the death threats differently. Maybe when I was in that position, I didn't take them too seriously. But now I think they might have been. And yeah, so those were the ones that were scary. And again, men and women get those death threats. And so right now in Ecuador, entering into politics is actually, if you want to do that, you have to be willing to sacrifice a lot, which is horrible.
But did you do something about it, or did you decide to stay calm and ignore it?
I think it depended. So, like I said, because I had a wonderful team of people with me, it depended on what I wanted to react to. So there was an episode of particularly, I think, political violence I experienced, and it was initiated by a former congressman, now vice minister of government, Esteban Torres, who posted an incredibly distasteful comment about my history, he said, supposedly or hinting that I had an inadequate behavior history regarding my intimate and private life. And so the reason that he said that was because I criticized congressmen publicly that refused to work during the World Cup. And so he was one of them. And that was the way that he decided to reply. And that was one of the attacks that I actually thought it was important for me to say something when I was asked. And well, what I said was that precisely what we need is to have better congressmen. That was what the referendum wanted, better political representation, less mediocre, less machistas, and hopefully more ethical and prepared women that are actually going to serve the country. And they are not doing this just for the fame or for the power. And if you allow me, I was thinking about this because as you said, I am an alumni of the MPP. And I remember when we were studying foundations, we studied the ethics of politics. And I will never forget the first time I read Weber's lecture on politics as a vocation. And he describes where he talks about, you know, how vanity is the worst enemy of a politician, and how people that play the game of politics and harm others usually are empty and weak. And, you know, through that facade of big man or strong man or powerful man that shames someone, they are usually, there's usually hiding a weak soul. And I think this is the case of Esteban Torres. I think that he needed to shame me because he's actually a very weak man. And this is one of the points where I thought, no, this is something that I cannot pass. I have to say something. It's not correct that women have to, you know, put up with this. And like I said, I think you have to pick the moment. You have to know when to say something, when to be silent, but always you have to do something when someone is attacking you unfairly.
100%. And you know what I found shameful? Most of the times when men try to put us down as women, especially in politics, they always talk about our private life. And most of that are lies. And they can barely say something about our professional lives. But moving forward, I want to analyze this issue in a more of a local level. Okay? From your experience, you know, not just from presidency, as I assume you have interacted with many other women around many other spaces, you know, what forms does political violence take in Ecuador? And how effective are we in combating it? Who to blame?
Right. I think you're right on what you said before. I think that usually people criticize women because of their private conduct regarding sexual or intimate decisions. And they also do it with men, but in different contexts and in different ways. And I just also think that we should grow up as a society so that those comments are just no longer tolerated anymore. Just it isn't relevant. We shouldn't care. But anyway, for the question, so on a more local level, right? So I think I've had experience in the public sector, being just a public servant and also being a political figure. And I think that there are various ways that we find the dysfunctionality of our society. So in a more internal level, What I find is that in Ecuador, politics are usually marked by the lack of cooperation. So one of the ideas that I remember learning at Oxford was of Adam Smith and David Hume, and how humans need esteem and how humans need to feel valued just as much as we need food. And I remember thinking the problem in Ecuador, and particularly in politics, is that we have a low self-esteem as Ecuadorians, sadly. We feel less than everybody. And so that means that I am always taking care of my position of power. And so I'm not very likely to cooperate. And as a woman, I can say that actually this is, I think, an advantage to us, because I find that when I have to do negotiations with men, or when I have to deal with men in politics, they feel less competitive, maybe less violent, and they are more likely to cooperate and negotiate. At least that has been my experience.
May I interrupt you and sorry for that?
Yes.
Oh, you come from Oxford. You are, in a way, in another professional level in comparison to many people who work in politics in our country. Do you think that helped in your case?
Yeah. Yeah, it actually makes me sad. So I don't usually go around telling people, because I don't like it. So I'm not sure. I haven't thought of that. But I think not. But it would be hard for me to say. I think that it usually has to do with men being more cooperative with women.
Okay.
And so that's what I've experienced. But it's not the same with women. With women, sometimes, not always, but sometimes feel competition. And that can be a bit tricky to navigate. I think that the more we talk about these issues with honesty, the more we are able to change that kind of culture, and the more we're able to support each other.
Well, that's very interesting. Can you please give an example of this competition between women in our context?
Yeah, I mean, so actually a few weeks ago, I posted something on my ex account, which I am not usually posting after the referendum. I wanted to go back to my normal life, but whenever I feel like there's something important that needs to be said, I do. And I received a comment of a woman, a law professor, constitutional law professor. I'd actually shared a few panels with her. She's a feminist. And she has never been rude to me in person, but on Twitter, I mean, on X, she's very violent. And she's always saying things like, oh, you should shut up. You should never speak again because you lost the referendum, and you lied to people and stuff like that. And I was thinking, I usually don't reply. I usually don't engage in this violent. And I was thinking, maybe because I stopped being a politician, and I thought, okay, I'm going to reply.
Yeah, right.
And so what I got from her was this, just, so I asked her, okay, when did I lie? Just show me a video where I said what you think. And she couldn't. And so this is the kind of things that I think. So this is one of the occasions where I felt that this was she was disagreeing with me, of course, but it was something more behind it. She was so angry at me because I have a different political view from her. And I think this is just not healthy. We need to learn how to disagree with each other in a civilized manner, regardless of, I mean, if you think different, if I think different, that's something to be celebrated, and we should listen to each other. It's not something that should be, you know, we shouldn't get violent around people thinking different from us. Yeah.
What freaks me out a bit whenever I think about the referendum, and I go back to what you just said, that everything was on your shoulders. She's saying you lost. It's like the referendum had your name. That's just nonsense. And connected to that, I wanted to ask you, what do you think would have happened if the front face of this referendum would have been a man?
Yeah, I'm not sure. So I think it depends on who the man was.
Talk about that, please, so, in the Ecuadorian context.
Yeah. I think it would have depended on who the man was. So this is something interesting. When people were asked about the things that they liked about me being the person that explained the referendum, they said that they liked that I was sweet, that I was calm, that I was explaining myself in technical in a technical manner, and that's because of also my personality. So I usually try to explain things from a rational point of view. So I think that actually the fact that the female, the image of the referendum was a female, and not only me, there were other women that were talking about the referendum, although I naturally was the main face of the referendum. I think it helped. So, but I said it's a difficult question because I'm not sure what would have happened, particularly like a standard man, like the normal politician would have taken this responsibility. I think it would have not necessarily been a good thing. Yeah, but I'm not sure.
No, it's okay. Thank you for answering that. I know it was kind of a tough one, but anyway, I'll keep going. Actually, I was thinking that maybe the path to address this should contain a formal legal framework. Although this is not a new issue, as you may know, it has become relevant in the policy and regulatory field. And in that regard, and as you're a lawyer, how would you assess the effectiveness of legal frameworks or institutional mechanisms in addressing and preventing gender-based violence in political settings?
So I think our legal framework and our institutions are in decay. Not only addressing political violence, but addressing most of the crimes that are committed. So we're seeing this, like I mentioned at the beginning, we see this with the case The Purge, we see this with the case Metastasis, we see how infiltrated the Narcos has been into our judiciary system. Journalists, politicians, lawyers, everybody.
That point later on about media, but yeah. Keep going.
But so particularly for me, journalism, it felt like such a betrayal. But yeah, we'll talk about that later. So I think that if everything else is falling apart due to corruption and unethical behavior from political leaders mainly, it's only to be expected that also when it comes to political violence, it's going to fail. So I was thinking about what happens to the general prosecutor every day. So every day, every 3 hours or 4 hours or even less, former President Rafael Correa posts in his X account things like that woman, that negligent woman, stupid, idiot. He even talks about her in terms of her race because he's a Black woman. So I think, like, where are the legal frameworks within the political party? Why isn't anybody in that movement saying, why is this man still talking about about women like this? Of course, it doesn't work. And also, why can she be protected legally? And sadly, our electoral norms are not sufficient to protect women that have not been elected. And she didn't get elected. She was appointed by the Transitory Council. So she can't even use that framework. That is the only framework that exists to protect women from violence. So I think it's not working well, as in general, it's not working well. But particularly, our norms are not ready yet to protect women that are in politics and are not necessarily elected, are in position of power and are continuously being harmed by men, like happens to her all the time. So legally, I would propose changing the electoral code, which is something, so the referendum included reforms to the electoral code, not gender policies, sadly, but I think it would be a good start. Like I said, the electoral norms should protect, so political violence should also embrace women in position of power that are not necessarily elected by the people. So like Diana Salazar. So for me, she is a woman that currently under the legal Ecuadorian system, she's basically an orphan. She's not protected because of how we perceive political violence. So I would do that. I think that would be a first legal reform.
I completely agree. Now let's touch a topic I always like to address, as I told you, and that is the role of the media. You know, I personally think it plays a significant role in shaping public discourse around gender violence. In that sense, how do media representations or narratives, in this case, perpetuate the violence you experience?
I had a good relationship with traditional media. I'm not talking about social media. So TV, national TV, news, anything that is not digital, right? So what I was thinking is that even when I went to opposition, to the opposition channels, they were okay. They were professional. However, I was trying to figure out what their role could be, and so this incident about Esteban Torres came back to me because that was a bit, so that went viral on social media. So my response to him went viral. I remember. I went on an interview in a digital media, and that response went viral. And nobody asked me, and the traditional media, nobody said anything about that, which I found it rare because it was just a time of my life where anything I did ended up in the media. I went to somewhere to have lunch, they ended up in the media. So I found it interesting that they remained silent about that. And I was thinking about what it could be that made them not comment about that particular exchange. And I think it might be that, so first of all, a lot of the journalists are men. I think there's a male prevalence. But also, I think that many are scared of saying the wrong thing, particularly because it has become a very loaded issue to talk about gender. And they're worried about saying the wrong thing. And so I never got asked anything about that in any kind of interview after that. And they never wrote anything about it. Even people that really don't like Esteban Torres never mention it in the traditional media. So that's my guess. So that's what I would think. It's their role. Maybe they should be better prepared to talk about controversial issues like this without fear of being cancelled or, I don't know, being stoned by popular opinion.
I have another question. I know you said you were the main face behind the referendum, but there were also other powerful women around that political process, I remember. Do they experience the same level of harassment as yours? Do you ever talk about it together while working?
Yes, of course. They are unbelievably strong women and men, because we had also men talking about the referendum. And I think when we used to talk about this and when we get together and talk about our experience, what was guiding us through it all was, so we really wanted to do what's best for Ecuador. I think that was it. So we were staying together. I used to tell them, don't read that to me. I don't want to know anymore by the end. And so the same, I felt the same from them. But I think that what glued us together and what kept us going through unbelievably and inhumanly even work hours was the fact that we really wanted this to, we thought this was good for the country. We had a cause that really guided us. And I think that when we lost, for us, or at least for me, the biggest thing that I had to process was not my personal failure, because luckily I don't see it like that, but just thinking that I didn't do enough. Just, you know, that thing of what else could I have done? How could I have served my country better? Was I maybe too, maybe I shouldn't have accepted that and let someone else better prepared take the role? But those are the kind of questions that you get. And suddenly the violence and the attacks, they don't matter. What keeps you going is the commitment to and the responsibility you have to serve a country like ours that really, really needs us.
That was inspiring, and thank you for your answer. I want to go back a bit and talk about the fact of being silent. as I know and as you know, many tragedies happen to you many times and in many ways. And in that sense, if we remain silent, how can we raise awareness and create a safer environment for women in politics? When and where should we talk?
So I think that the most important thing that we can do is to create, to lead by example. I think that that is the impact that women that get into politics, or that the impact of women that do what you do right now, that you try to have a conversation about this and you prepare yourself to become a better public servant and you keep preparing. And so opening the way for more women and men that want to serve our country, I think that that is the best way to keep going. And it's not easy to lead by example, because as we said at the very beginning, we are human. We make mistakes. We have our weak moments. And it is easy to sit down and criticize. And it's easy to know how to deal with your own flaws. It is very difficult to know how to deal with your own flaws. So, but for me, that would be it. I think that we need more women in leading, but leading from ethics, like really doing the leadership work.
I totally support that. But as you may know, and as we have discussed, the risks are sometimes too high. They make women think twice when it comes to run for politics. And sometimes they think, oh, I want to have a family and I don't want to expose them to horror. Sometimes I think about that, for example. And in that sense, you know, can you offer some advice in addition to what you just said to women who want to enter politics? I want to do that someday. But then again, I see your experience and of course, I totally admire it. But then I wonder, should I be doing the exact same thing?
So the best thing that I can say, so I'm going to speak completely honestly here. So you should not do it unless you are completely sure why you're doing it. So the only reason that I didn't resign, because I wasn't there for, you know, I didn't need it to be there. So the only reason that I didn't resign was because I had a cause and a team and we were fighting together. So if you want the glory, if you want to be famous, if you want to you know, become, you know, you want to go to the news, of course, you can do that from the academia. And I think it's a very important role. Of course, I think it's very important. But if you want to get your hands dirty, as Weber would say, then you have to basically sell your soul, which is you have to know that you're going to be losing a lot. In every country, and particularly in Ecuador, where you're going to get accused of robbery, you're going to get accused of corruption, you're going to get accused of everything, even if you didn't do it, especially if you didn't do it, because that's how it works. And so my biggest advice would be only go into politics if you have a real reason that's going to keep you through the hardest moments, if you really have a cause. And if you want the glory, that's not. Politics is not, it's not for, I don't think it should be attracting people who want the glory. The glory is something that may happen for a minute and then the consequences of it. And yeah, so just be sure of your commitment.
I totally agree. And that was brilliant, honestly. In that sense, will we see you back in politics soon? I think, you know, for people like you.
So not soon. So I'm focusing right now in my research. I want to take time to think and really reflect on what happened. I've been in the public service for a few years now. And I just think that being too close to power can mess with your perspective and can limit the way, can mess with your perspective. So I want to take a step back, give back in different ways. So I'm teaching, I'm doing research. I really try to understand from a rational perspective what's going on with all the violence, what is really going on with all the violence that we are experimenting. And so that if in a couple of years or maybe decades, the opportunity presents itself again, and I feel prepared, which I think is the most important thing. If I feel prepared, emotionally, intellectually, ethically speaking, to what public service actually represents, then I will accept it. And I want to take this opportunity to say something, because sometimes we celebrate women being in power just because women are in power. And of course, it's good. I mean, I think it's a good thing. But I also think we should thrive, or we should aim to ethically, like I said, ethically prepared women that are not just for the glory, prepared women that studied, that have experience on the things that they are talking about, so that we give a lesson to men. This is how it should be done. This is how commitment to our country looks like. This is what actual leadership looks like. It looks like sacrifice. It looks like courage. It looks a lot like assuming the responsibility for your decisions and your words. So I think we women, we have the potential to become that and more. And hopefully if someone saw me dealing with all of these, they got inspired. And I think that is the best thing that I could have done. Really, I honestly think that is the best and the greatest honor that I could have.
That's fascinating to hear. I wish I could go on, but we're running out of time. I'm so sorry. However, thank you so, so much for this enlightening conversation, which I fully enjoyed. And thanks, everyone, for listening again. Have a great day.